Made possible in part by Kranert Center for the Performing Arts, announcing Summerfest 2004, three rotating evenings of engaging theater. Performances take place Tuesdays through Sundays, June 18th to August 1st. For a Summerfest brochure, contact the Kranert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit KranertCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we look into the debates over religious expression in public schools. These debates have a very long history. Our guest this afternoon is Joan Delfatore. She is professor of English and Legal Studies at the University of Delaware and the author of The Fourth Are Conflicts Over Religion in America's Public Schools. In her book, she documents the history of our arguments over religion in the classroom. In the 19th century, the debates spilled into the streets. In 1844, there was a confrontation between Catholics and Protestants that resulted in the deaths of 20 people. Today, the debate continues, and it is often heated. But the Supreme Court in the 20th century handed down landmark decisions making religion in the public schools subject to the U.S. Constitution and federal law. And so today we await the court's decision in a case challenging a teacher's right to lead his or her class in a Pledge of Allegiance that includes the words, One Nation Under God. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to the fourth R, Joan Delfatore is the author of What Johnny Shouldn't Read, Textbook Censorship in America. Both books are published by Yale University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Joan Delfatore, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, since I mentioned it in the introduction and we are waiting for action from the court, what are your thoughts on the case before the court regarding the pledge?
If you mean what do I think they're going to do, if we base it on history, historically what the court has done every time a new school prayer issue has reached them is it has said that the first case that came to it was to be dismissed because the plaintiff did not have standing. And as you may know, Michael Newdow, mm-hmm. the atheist who brought this case about Under God and the Pledge, is not the custodial parent of his daughter, which means one possibility is that the court could say that because he's not the custodial parent, he doesn't have standing to bring the suit.
Well, that would be one way out, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, the first time a case came to the Supreme Court about Bible reading in the public schools, first graduation prayer case, first prayer about silence and moments of silence in the schools, first case about Bible clubs in the schools. In every one of those instances, the court dismissed it on the ground that the plaintiff did not have standing. So it would certainly not be without precedent if that's what the court did about this one.
Hmm. Well, what do you think of the arguments were heard in March of this year, 2004? What were your thoughts about the arguments that were made before the court?
I thought Mr. Newdow, who represented himself, made a very good argument. When he opened his argument, he said something that he could not have said as effectively if it had been a lawyer representing him. It really had to be the parent speaking for himself. He looked up at the justices and he said, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, he said, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. And every school day, the government tells my little girl that her daddy is wrong about God. And every school day, the government tells my little girl that in their opinion, she should put her hand on her heart and say that she thinks her father is wrong about God, and I don't think that's the government's job, which is a very compelling argument even for people who themselves would like to say the pledge that way. Is it the public school's job to take a stand on whether God exists? In my view, it's not. I think that the public schools, that the government, should leave the matter of religion to the people. Doesn't mean that religion should be private in the sense of being hidden, but I think that it should be public in the sense of being brought to public notice by the people themselves and not by the government.
Hmm. Now, the Bush administration, the Solicitor General, argued that the pledge was simply a patriotic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting as well. It's a simple, ceremonial, patriotic exercise. And I do believe that the justices also, you know, questioned Mr. Newdow, asking him, well, on our currency, it says, in God we trust. We open the court session with God Save the United States in this honorable court.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is a great deal of resistance to what Mr. Newdow is saying, and certainly the justices seem to be quite negative toward the position he was taking. Now, of course, what he says is, yes, the Pledge of Allegiance is a patriotic act. It is a ceremonial patriotic act. And until 1954, it did not have the words under God in it. So his position was, before 1954, it was a simple patriotic act in which any American, regardless of their religious belief, could say, I am a loyal, patriotic American. I pledge allegiance to the flag. I support this country. Mr. Newdow's argument is that after 1954, when those words under God were added because of the communist scare at that time, his position is that that made the pledge divisive, that someone who does not believe in God is not able to say in that form, I am a loyal, patriotic American. And as he pointed out, when the House of Representatives passed that legislation, the committee that put it forward said in its report that that was its intent, that to counter atheistic communism, Congress had decided that anybody who wanted to say, I am a patriotic American, should be compelled at the same time to say that he or she believes in God. And that's what Mr. Newdow feels is not the government's job.
Mm. Well, you note right from the get-go in the fourth R that we have an impulse to put together majoritarian religious belief and patriotism. And mm-hmm. not only does this go back to the Cold War, when school prayer was touted as a guard against communism, we've also seen this more recently following Columbine and mm-hmm. September 11th. Why is the impulse to link prayer and patriotism so strong?
Well, I think for one thing, it has to do with membership in a group, an assertion that I am a member of this group. One thing I think is very interesting in that regard, the people who do not like that kind of ceremonial use of God include not only non-believers, but also people who take God so seriously that it offends them to have the government say, this is just a ceremonial act, this mention of God. They feel if it is indeed just a ceremonial act, then the mention of God is inappropriate. So when you talk about combining patriotism with religious belief, it's not a matter that non-believers don't want to do it and believers do. The community of believers in America is divided, as is the case with communities of believers in other countries. It's divided between people who are comfortable with a kind of ceremonial God bless America assertion that membership in our group, loyalty to our particular cause, includes mention of a common religious belief. And those believers who feel that unless you are really, sincerely, meaningfully praying to God, you ought not to include the name of God in what really amounts to a citizenship exercise.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about another contemporary issue. That's displays of the Ten Commandments in the mm-hmm. public square. Are disputes over this related to religion in the public schools? You know, let's look back to the case of Alabama Judge Roy Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Are these related?
I think they're very closely related. No. You mentioned the term public square, and there is an important distinction there. Anybody who wants to put the Ten Commandments on his or her lawn, any private employer who wants to post the Ten Commandments, anybody who wants to put the Ten Commandments on a T-shirt, on a bumper sticker, is absolutely free to do that. The question is whether the government should promulgate the Ten Commandments. Now, Judge Moore had that large monument put in the atrium of the courthouse, and busloads of people came and started literally worshiping at it. And lawyers who used that courthouse brought a lawsuit saying that Judge Moore had inappropriately turned the courthouse into a place of worship. What made that such a meaningful case is that the Ten Commandments are displayed elsewhere in government buildings, including in the Supreme Court chamber. But in those contexts, the Ten Commandments is part of a larger display. In the Supreme Court, for example, the Ten Commandments, Moses receiving the Ten Commandments, is part of a larger display of lawgivers over history. So you have Hammurabi, you have Muhammad, a variety of lawgivers, including Moses. In the case of Judge Moore, the Ten Commandments were placed by themselves as an assertion that Judeo-Christian law is the same, essentially, as American government law. And that is why the courts, of course, said, no, you can't do that, they're here.
Hmm. Well, what about that issue of that people will raise, that we have a Judeo-Christian tradition in this country?
Well, the question would be, what is the Judeo-Christian tradition? One of the things that's kind of funny about this, when people talk about the founders of this country having founded it as a Judeo-Christian country, the truth is the founders of this country would roll in their graves at that idea. They would never have said that Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism are all on the same plane, and they certainly wouldn't have said that we should talk about some kind of generic God also worshipped by Muslims, and if you want to take it very broadly, by Hindus and Buddhists and so on, if you want to take the concept of a divinity that broadly, they would have been horrified by that. They were absolutely clear and explicit that what they were talking about was Christianity, and what they meant by Christianity was Protestantism. So really, it is more historically authentic when people say, when people want to make the argument, this is a Christian nation. Whether you agree or disagree with that argument, historically they have a lot more basis for saying that's the basis on which it was founded. But as far as the law is concerned, American law was founded on English common law, which has many things in common with the Ten Commandments, such as don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, at least not under certain circumstances. But those same concepts can be found in many other belief systems, including secular belief systems. So the notion that somehow the Judeo-Christian religion is the one that should be promulgated by the government is a viewpoint many people hold, but I don't think you can say historically that you have a lock on it because the founders of this country were largely Christian.
Hmm. If you find yourself engaged in discussion today about religion in the public schools, you're likely to hear that prayer is forbidden, God's been kicked out, and we're in all kinds of trouble because of that in our classrooms, including violence like the violence that happened in Colorado. Mm-hmm. What would your contribution to the discussion be if you found yourself today in that space?
I would suggest that people go to the United States Department of Education website, where you will find the U.S. Department of Ed's statement on what religious activities are permitted in the schools. What you will find there is that certainly there are still some gray areas, some areas where it's not clear whether a particular kind of religious activity is okay. But generally speaking, the courts have never said that the students can't pray in school. What the courts have said is that the government cannot sponsor any particular religious activity. So if, for example, students are sitting around a lunch table and they agree among themselves that they want to begin by asking a blessing over the lunch, they're absolutely free to do that. If a student wants to start a prayer group that meets before or after school or at lunchtime, students are absolutely free to do that. It is not true that the students can't pray in school. What the Supreme Court has said is that the school officials may neither encourage nor inhibit the personal religious beliefs of the students. Going back to Mr. Newdow, Mr. Newdow's argument is that the Supreme Court has consistently said that the government may not take any stand about religion that favors one religious view over another. He says that the court is inconsistent if it allows the schools to promote monotheism, belief in a single God, and says, well, that doesn't really count as religion, because what the courts have done consistently is to say the students can exercise whatever religion they choose as long as they're on their own time in the school and they're not compelled to be there or compelled to do it.
Yeah. This was interesting to read in your book, The Fourth R, that the policies, to quote you, the policies of law-abiding schools have become friendlier toward religion mm-hmm. as a result of our student-centered approach. Mm-hmm. Although religion is far less prevalent in public schools today than in 1880, it's somewhat more so than in 1980.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. What happened was that when the Supreme Court said in 1963 that the traditional Bible reading and recitation of the Lord's Prayer under the auspices of the school was unconstitutional, people said, oh, that means no religion is allowed in the school. And people on both sides said that. People who didn't want religion in the school exaggerated what the court had done. They said, see, we won. No religion in the school. Ironically, people who wanted religion in the school, because they couldn't see any other way to do it but the way it had always been done, also said, God has been kicked out of the school. We can't have any religion. Well, the school officials, who are not lawyers, hearing this from all sides, thought it was true. And so it became true, because the school officials did inhibit students from exercising their religion in the schools, which the school officials had absolutely no right to do. In the 1980s, a very religious man named Samuel Erickson, he was at the time the legal director of the Christian Legal Society, said, let's think outside the box. Instead of thinking about how do we bring back state-sponsored prayer, why don't we talk about how the students can pray in a meaningful way? He's one of many religious voices who said that they did not like watered-down civic prayers. They wanted meaningful prayer in the school, which meant that each student had to pray as he or she saw fit, either individually or in groups. So he started bringing lawsuits against schools that would not allow students to have Bible clubs or other kinds of public religious activities. And he won some, he lost some, but the main thing he did was he got the attention of Senator Mark Hatfield from Oregon, who sponsored what was called the Equal Access Act. And that says that if a school has, if a secondary school that takes public federal money has any non-curricular clubs, then they cannot exclude a club because of, quote, the religious, political, philosophical, or other content of the speech. Well, once that law was passed and was upheld by the Supreme Court, schools began to allow Bible clubs, gospel choirs, prayer groups before and after school, prayer groups at lunchtime. So there is more religion in the schools today than there was right after the Supreme Court's ruling in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Joan Delvatore. She's professor of English and Legal Studies at the University of Delaware and the author of The Fourth R, Conflicts Over Religion in America's Public Schools. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. One on the toll-free line, apparently listening on the internet this afternoon in San Francisco. Line four, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask about the development of a virtual Taliban by the religious right. And I guess to start, I wanted to ask a question. If your guest has got knowledge of the development of the Right to Life movement, it's been my understanding that John Ehrlichman, after Richard Nixon was caught at Watergate and before he was impeached, Richard Nixon realized that he needed to have some true, devoted, hold-no-prisoners kinds of allies. So he got John Ehrlichman to develop the nonprofit that we call the Right to Life movement. And that he latched on to the early abortion ruling and essentially developed these I don't want to call them mindless robots, but people who would not, you know, take no for an answer. And so every time Richard Nixon got in trouble, he just called on these allies that he had developed in this Right to Life movement. Do you have any knowledge of that?
I don't know a great deal about the Right to Life movement as such. I think that certainly there are people who believe certain things. That's what they believe. They're not going to discuss it. I have interviewed people who tell me that God told them certain things, and they mean literally God told them. I had one gentleman who told me that God had told him something when he was shaving that morning. And you obviously can't continue the conversation from that point on. But I would disagree with the idea that the religious right is necessarily as regimented as that in their thinking. For example, some of the strongest opponents of religion in the public schools in the sense of state-sponsored religion are evangelical Christians who undoubtedly are part of the Right to Life movement, and yet they split from some of their cohorts in that movement when it comes to issues of school prayer. So, for instance, in 1998, when two competing proposals were on the floor for a constitutional amendment to restore state-sponsored school prayer, the leaders of these two competing constitutional amendments, which were quite different from each other, in the sense that one would have restored state-sponsored prayer, the other one would have strengthened private prayer within the schools or within public buildings, both of those were led by evangelical Christians, who are all part of the Right to Life movement. So I think what you're talking about is probably a subset rather than necessarily the whole thing.
Well, I agree, and I'm glad that you made that qualification, because it's my understanding that, you know, even though you did note that subset, the vast number of people are not that that educated in biblical theology. And when you come up with, you know, TV preachers that essentially just yell at you hour after hour after hour that you will go to hell unless you believe a certain way, that scares the holy bejesus out of 99% of them, and they will obey. If I remember right, Ronald Reagan had and George Bush Sr. had developed a scheme to essentially fill the prison the Federal Protective Services were predominantly Mormons and certain types of Baptists, and essentially these were people who will, you know, essentially take orders very effectively. This whole torture business. Now we're hearing about the the general who was busted because he was going around talking about the crusade that we were doing, Ten Commandments down in that courthouse. Every time we turn, I'm just wondering about the development of this religious right as a political Taliban to protect George Bush against impeachment. And I'm very concerned that it very much smells fishy, that every time George Bush does something ugly, you hear about these. It's almost as if they're doing these Manchurian candidate turn of a card to trigger these religious right people to protect George Bush at all costs.
Well, there I would have to defer to whatever you have read elsewhere, because that is not any part of what I get into in the research that I do. I certainly did hear about that general who was saying that this was that the war in Iraq was a crusade, and I believe they did get a lid on him. But certainly that viewpoint is prevalent among supporters of the war in Iraq. But as I say, that is outside the area that I do research on.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we're going to go and talk with another caller now in Lovington on line one. Hi.
Hi, I've got a question
sure.
for you, and I was going to make a comment. It doesn't have much to do with the question, but is it legal for a school that allows outside groups to come in and, well, specifically use the gymnasium to ban that activity on Sundays?
It's not legal to ban the activity on Sunday. Well, I'm sorry, no.
I mean not allow them to use that gymnasium for the exact same activity on Sunday.
A school can make what they call time, place, and manner restrictions. In other words, a school can say the school building is not open to any group for any purpose on a Sunday. What they can't do is say the school building is open to certain community groups but not others based on the viewpoint. A decision you might want to look at, a fairly recent one, it's called Lamb's Chapel versus Center Moriches. The Lamb's Chapel decision was a case where a school had said that community groups could use the school building after school hours or on the weekends. A particular group wanted to use the school to show films about family life from a religious perspective. It was the Lamb's Chapel congregation that wanted to use the school for that purpose, and the school said no because it was religious. The Supreme Court said the school could not make that distinction, that the school could not say that other groups could use the school facilities to discuss various issues related to family matters, but then close the school to a group that wanted to do this from a religious viewpoint. However, the school can say the school is open to any group until 6 p.m., or the school is not open to any group except between 6 and 9 Monday to Friday. That the school can do.
Okay. So as long as they never said you're supposed to be in church and not playing basketball, they're okay.
Correct.
Okay.
As long as they don't do something that clearly allows you to prove that it was for a religious purpose.
Right.
They can say, for example, we need to close the school building Sunday because we don't want to turn the heat on.
Right. My comment was that it seems to me like I've got some, lots of email from people very concerned about my faith, I guess. And it seems to me like, you know, I'm listening to you say that, you know, the kids can pray on their own individually or in groups as long as they, you know, it's their own idea for, you know, in free periods.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of stuff where people basically say that, you know, based on some kind of rallying cry thing, that, you know, everybody's getting chased. You know, you can't mention the word God in school or you're going to get chased out. I mean, it almost sounds to me like they're telling themselves that and they're beginning to believe it.
I think that's true, and not just telling themselves that, but various advocacy groups. And as I said before, it's both people who want more religion in the schools and people who want less religion in the schools keep saying God has been kicked out of the public schools. The funny thing that happens sometimes when students are engaging, like there was a case in Paducah, Kentucky, where a student pastor from a high school had started a prayer group that was meeting every day in the atrium of the public school. It was meeting before school started. It was in a part of the building where they would have been perfectly free to stand in that same place and talk about cars or movies or whatever else they wanted to talk about, and they were holding a prayer group. And some people complained to the ACLU, and the ACLU said the only way we would step into this case is if anybody tried to stop them from doing that. So it really is not true that if you have prayer in the school, somehow the courts are going to stop you or some liberal group is going to stop you. If it is clearly the student's own idea and initiated by the students and run by the students, and that was the case with the Paducah, Kentucky group, there is nothing in the law and nothing in Supreme Court decisions that would justify school officials in acting as some kind of a prayer police to break that up. If school officials do that, I would certainly encourage people to write to the advocacy group of your choice, whether it's anything from the ACLU to the Christian Legal Society to the American Center for Law and Justice, and tell them what's going on and ask them to send a letter to the school officials clarifying what is or is not allowed.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Next we go to a caller on line two. Listener in Urbana, hi.
Hi. Listening intently. There was a study last year that indicated that when nations' overall levels of religious belief and attendance are high, mm-hmm. its citizens voice greater disapproval of divorce, homosexuality, abortion, and prostitution issues involving sexual morality. Mm-hmm. I'm reading from a press release, but religiosity is less likely to spur such disapproval for cheating on taxes or accepting bribes in public office. I was out of Penn State, and which I think fits pretty good, pretty well with a lot of the people who want more religion in the classroom, but I wanted to ask you about something I read locally. There was an article in the local paper that mentioned a professor of Judaism here at the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a public school, so, you know, I was kind of taken aback. And I tried to kind of half-heartedly looked into it and saw that they had some sort of department on religious studies or
mm-hmm.
something like that. But I'm just curious, is this a widespread, you know, is this widespread, or have there been any court cases involving the teaching of religious, you know, or religious studies in general in public universities?
Actually, you raised 3 points, so to answer them in order, you mentioned the study out of Penn State, and since I went to Penn State, I have to say, go Paterno. I mean, they program us to do that. You also mentioned the business about the effect on homosexuality, and that could also be said of things like a pro-choice position and so on. That is one of the reasons people are uncomfortable with the government promoting any particular religious view. If individuals, even if they are out in public in large groups, very loud, but they're acting as individuals, if they are practicing their religion that way, that's something they have a right to do. But people are uncomfortable with the government promoting religion because religion tends to be associated with certain social views or certain attitudes towards certain kinds of people. And there is a sense that everybody should be treated equally by the government, regardless of what the majority chooses to do when they act as private citizens. Answering the main thing you asked, the Supreme Court has several times said that none of it has said explicitly that its decisions are not meant to be taken to mean that you can't teach about religion. So not only in a public university, but even in a public elementary or high school, if you wanted to run a course in comparative religion, or if you mentioned a professor of Judaism, and I would assume that there's a department such as you mentioned, a department of comparative religion, or a department of philosophy that might have people who teach about religion, the only thing that would be forbidden is an attempt to indoctrinate or proselytize. And at the college level, even that would be a little bit difficult to get a grip on, because the assumption is that these students are there voluntarily, that they are adult, that professors in classes are going to express viewpoints which may be political or whatever. I think if you had a professor who was actively trying in a public university to use his or her official position to proselytize for a particular religion, I do not know of any court case to that effect. I think you could probably make a case that that was unacceptable. But if what they're doing is teaching the history of Judaism, the practices of Judaism, anything that is simply neutral teaching about Judaism or about any other religion, that certainly is in the wide collection of things that would be permitted.
Well, that makes sense. Would that though preclude the possibility that you know, somebody could approach the university and say, well, you're teaching Judaism, how about Islam or how about Buddhism, that kind of thing?
Certainly people could approach the university and say that. The university would have to show some kind of a neutral reason for teaching about a particular religion and not another. But suppose, for instance, the university says, our courses on comparative religion are taught by our own faculty who have to have doctorates. So if somebody came in from the community with a bachelor's degree who just wanted to teach a course in his or her religion because they wanted to teach that religion, the university could say no to that. What they probably would have more trouble with would be if it came from the students. If there were a movement among the students to say, we have a course in the history of Judaism, why can't we have a course in the history of Islam? That if the university kept insisting only Judeo-Christianity, nothing else, I could see where you could start getting in a wrestling match about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I would imagine that any religious studies program that didn't have both of those things would not be a very good program.
Oh, and I think today really the scramble is the opposite. It's the scramble today is to include Islam. There was a controversy that I don't remember the details of. It was, I believe, Stanford University has freshmen do some kind of reading over the summer,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted them to read a book about the Quran. And that started a controversy from people who thought they should not read a book about the Quran.
Hmm. Well, I remember being a student in college, and in literature courses, we read examples of literature from various religious traditions.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And really, at any level, you can do that. It's unfortunate, I think, that there isn't more teaching about religion, even in elementary and secondary schools. The thing that prevents it really isn't so much atheists. It's a concern on the part of school officials and textbook publishers that once they start talking about religion, they become embroiled in all kinds of arguments about how you presented my religion, how you presented the other religion, how many pages did you give to this religion versus that religion. It becomes so hard to manage that it tends to discourage public school officials from teaching about religion at all. And I think that's a very unfortunate thing.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the, at the beginning of the book, you outlined some recent incidents involving religion in the public schools. Mm-hmm. And one of them was very interesting, I thought, and pretty thorny. If I was in the teacher's shoes in this situation, I might not be thinking on my feet that very moment. But a first grade teacher allows students to read aloud from books they bring from home. When one little boy comes in with a beginner's Bible, the teacher has him read from it to her alone, not to the whole class. And this resulted in the boy's mother filing suit. There are gray area situations, and, you know, I'm wondering, you know, if you could have had that teacher's ear at the moment, what would your advice have been for her?
I think she did the best thing she could mm-hmm. under the circumstances. And the upshot of that case, it ended up in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. They took the unusual step of hearing the case, what they call en banc, all 14 of the Third Circuit judges. And, you know, Federal Court of Appeals is pretty high up. When the 14 of them heard that case, they tied 7-7. So it shows you how thorny this is. Memory serves, I believe that was a first-year teacher. Can you picture somebody 21, 22 years old, first-year teacher, confronted with a constitutional question that she has about 2 seconds to decide that eventually ends up tying a federal court of appeals? That's really part of the problem in the schools today, is when religion gets brought into the school, as you said, there are some gray areas where it's not that clear whether it's the teacher or the student in charge. One of the things the court said about that case, this was a first grade class, so the kids are 6 years old. If the teacher had allowed the child to read the beginner's Bible to the class, would six-year-olds have understood that she wasn't thereby approving the message? But the other way around, when she wouldn't let him read it, mm-hmm. were they to understand that she was disapproving the message? It's not that clean where you can say, well, see, it's the student's activity over here and the teacher's over there. In the real life of public schools, those two things blend together all the time.
Mm. Yeah. Well, when you step back and you think about it for a while, you can think of it as a teaching opportunity. You could have let the child go ahead. And then if there were questions from other students, you know, the teacher could have said, you know, something about, you know, what, a little bit about the history of the Bible, and then talk about other traditions and other pieces of religious law and literature.
Well, as so often happens, there were some circumstances in that particular case. I believe I put a footnote about this. That same student had a controversy when he was in the kindergarten because he made a religious poster, and his parents made an issue of where it was posted in the hallway. Mm. So I think one of the things that may have been in that teacher's mind is that this wasn't a one-time thing, that the parents of that child already had a track record. I believe this, by the time this particular case came up, I believe it was something like the third or fourth issue they had in the school, where the parents were actively using the child to evangelize the other children. So that may have had something to do with the teacher's response.
Hmm.
Now, again, if the child were simply talking to other children at the lunch table, that would have been something the child is permitted to do. The question was whether the solution you just mentioned would have ended it, or whether the next week it would have been something else.
Yeah. Well, there you wonder if the message isn't coming from home. A similar situation might be where a school official would tell students, you know, if you ask for this, you can have it. If you ask for a prayer group. So it, rather than the students coming forward by themselves to ask for it, it is the school official doing that.
That happened quite blatantly in a case in Mississippi, where a principal who did not ordinarily meet with the student council met with them specifically for the purpose of encouraging them to ask to have a prayer. Now, in that case, it was a prayer over the loudspeaker, and ultimately the court said that he couldn't, you couldn't have a prayer over the loudspeaker, even if it were voluntary on the part of the student saying the prayer, because of an issue called a captive audience situation. The rest of the kids are stuck in the school because the government says you have to be there. And then to turn the microphone over to volunteer students to lead a prayer is unacceptable, because, not because the students leading the prayer would not be volunteers, but because the students hearing the prayers would not be free to move away. I mean, if you contrast that with what I was talking about before, that prayer group in Paducah, Kentucky, it's a group of students praying out loud in the atrium, but the other students can simply walk past and go about their business and ignore it, which is not the case if it's a prayer over the loudspeaker. And they're told they have to sit in their homeroom and listen to it.
Today we come down on the side of the individual. We try not to trample on the rights of individual students in free speech. This not always the case. When you look back in time, the feeling was that the majority should prevail. And children were expected, were ordered to pray and or read from the Bible. Maybe you would, to wind up today, give us just a little bit of a history lesson here in terms of the view of religion in the public schools earlier in our history.
When the publicly funded schools first started in this country, they were teaching the doctrines of specific Protestant denominations. For example, in Massachusetts, they were teaching Congregationalism. Other religious denominations, Protestant denominations, objected to that. Around the 1830s, going into the 1840s, public schools decided, instead of teaching the specific religion of the majority, we will teach what they called non-sectarian religion. Today, I think we would call it pan-Protestantism. That's when the practices of reading the King James Bible, saying the Protestant version of the Lord's Prayer, became standard in the schools. Around the mid-1940s to 1950s, because of the communist scare, a number of states passed laws saying you have to have prayer in the school, even if they had been doing it for some time. If you look at the dates on the laws, they're all around the post-World War II period. Back in the 19th century, children were expelled. They were beaten for refusing to participate in prayer. Parents were sued by the schools for keeping their children out of prayers. By the time the Supreme Court ruled in the 1960s, the situation was 12 states required prayer in the schools, 9 states forbade prayer in the schools, and the rest of the states generally left it up to the local district. So it's not true that everybody had prayer in the school. The cases that were brought to the Supreme Court were originally brought by people whose children were being told that they had to participate in the prayer. It's not true that this was always voluntary. But by the 1960s, many religious people, including the vast majority of the clergy, when the question was put to them, they might not have thought of it before because they had just taken the school prayer for granted, but when the question was put to them, do you really think the state should be punishing children for refusing to participate in a government-sponsored form of worship? The vast majority of Americans, including clergy, including very religious people, said, no, the school should not force the kids to participate. Then they went a step farther and said, well, the school should not be endorsing that religion at all. So you can see a pretty clear trend from very strong majoritarianism. If it's the majority prayer and you go to this school, by golly, you say that prayer, to the situation today, which is very, very individual-oriented. The problem is when one person's individual rights conflict with another.
Yeah. Professor Del Fattori, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
And thank you for having me.
Joan Del Fiore has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's professor of English and Legal Studies at the University of Delaware and the author of The Fourth R, Conflicts Over Religion in America's Public Schools. Very good read, very lively read. The book is published by Yale University Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. On this shortened week of trade, as Friday is a national day of mourning for President Reagan and the grain floor at the Chicago Board of Trade, and of course the livestock at the Mercantile Exchange will be closed on that day. On this day, futures finished the day lower in the wheat pit but higher in the corn. July contract in the wheat, 363.5 on the high, the low at 358. A settlement price there at 360 was down 3 cents. September futures, 373, the high, the low at 368. Settlement price at 371, a penny and 3/4 lower. December futures, 384, the high, the low at 379. The settlement price at 381.5, down 2.25. In the March contract, 391, the high, the low at 386. Settled 389, down 2.75. A lot of position squaring going on over before this long weekend that's coming up, and actually before tomorrow morning's reports are released by USDA. That's the latest supply and demand reports. They're coming out 1 day early, of course, because the government will be closed on Friday. July corn now 298.75 high, low at 295.5. A settlement price 297.5. They finished up 0.5 cent on the day. September futures 303, the high, low at 297.75. Settled 302.25, and they were up 3.25. December contract in the corn pit 303, the high, the low at 297.75. A settlement price 302.5, up 3.25. In the March futures 307.5 high, low at 302, settled 307, up 3.25. May futures in the corn pit, 311, the high, the low at 305.25, a settlement price at 310.25, up 3 cents. In July 2005 corn, 310.5, the high, the low at 305.25, and a settlement price at 309.5, up 3 cents. New crop September, 289.5 high, low at 289, settled on the high, 289.5, unchanged. And new December, settled 273.75 high, this is 2005 new December. Settled at 273, rather, up 0.5 cent. The high was 273.75, the low at 272.5. July oats, 149.5 high, low at 146.25, settlement price at 146.75. They were up 0.5 cent on the day. And the September futures, 155.25 high, low at 152.5. September oats settled 152.5, up 1/4 for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby July soybeans for the day, unchanged. 863, the high, the low at 848, settlement price at 852 once again. That July contract settled unchanged on the day. August soybeans, 810 high, low at 796, the settlement price at $8.15, down 3.5 cents. September futures, 717, the high, the low at 708, settled 709.5, they were down 6 on the day. And the Novembers on out were lower as well. 682.5 the high in the Noves. The low at 674. Settlement price there at 679 for your new crop, down 5 cents. January beans, 684.5 the high. The low at 677. Settled 680.5, down 4. And the March futures, 682 the high. Low at 675. The settlement price, 679.5, down 5.5. And the May beans, 676, the high, the low at 671. Settlement price at 671, down 8 cents. Don't forget to tune in at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. That's just a few minutes away, and we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services this afternoon, like we do every Wednesday. We'll take a look at what tomorrow's reports might hold with Paul. July bean meal now, 274, the high, the low at 267.50. To the settlement price at 272.50, and they were up 380 on the day. The August meal, 262.50, high, low at 257.80, settled 262, up 360. July bean oil, 28.66, the high, the low at 28.16, and the settlement price, 28.21. They were down 21 on the day. August bean oil, 28.05, the high, the low at 27.52, settlement price there at 27.55, and the August bean oil settled at 27.55, down 26 for the day. That's a look at what happened to the Chicago Board of Trade. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. It was a lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange as far as the livestock prices go. Let's begin with August feeder cattle. The high today, 109.12.5. The low, 107. The settlement, 108.37.5. That down 12.5. September feeder cattle, 107.30. The high, the low, 105.95. The settlement, 107.05. That up 2.5 cents. October feeder cattle, 106.50 the high, 105 even the low, 105.87.5 the settlement, that down 17.5. June live cattle, 90.05 the high, 87.97.5 the low, the settlement, 89.47.5, that down 17.5. August live cattle, 89.50 the high, 87.85 the low, 89.15 the settlement, that up 25. June lean hogs, 78.87.5 the high, 78.10 the low, 78.15 the settlement, that down 55. July, 76.90 the high, 75.40 the low, 75.47.5 the settlement, that down 82.5. August lean hogs, 75.80 the high, 74.87.5 the low, the settlement, 75.45, that down 20. October lean hogs, 64.05 the high, 63.45 the low, 63.80 the settlement, that down 10. July bellies, 110.75 the high, 108.40 the low, 109.02.5 the settlement, that down 32.5. The Dow is down 34 points at 10,399, the NASDAQ off 25 points at 1998, and the S&P 500 is 7 points lower at 1135.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dan Hunter from Des Moines, Iowa writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why don't spiders get caught in their own webs?"
Psychologists long ago insisted that spider webs were merely projections from the unconscious mind of the spider, kind of arachnid virtual reality version of accumulated neurosis. But now we know the explanation's much simpler than that. Spiders have their feet coated with Teflon. The webs are spun from Velcro. If webs were Teflon or spider feet were coated with Velcro, they'd be prisoners of their homes, like so many of us. But nature is wise, crafty, and elegant, as well as cynical and malevolent.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK or visit us on the web at www.drscience.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. You can visit us on the web at WILL.UIUC.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. The producer for the show is Harriet Williamson. Let's take a look at the